Hello and welcome to Inside Education. My name is Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on today's programme.
There is no practice without theory. Unless we have a theoretical basis on which we base our practice, then there is no practice, or there's just poor practice.
To mark the publication of a new Irish core text for the foundation disciplines of educational studies, we speak to its editor, Dr. Brendan Walsh from Dublin City University, about the foundation disciplines of education. But first, as always, we go to Barry Hennessy for this week's news. You're welcome again, Barry.
Hello again, Sean. Now, there's an issue that's been doing the rounds ever since the economic crisis first began to hit schools. It's been championed most notably by the Teachers Union of Ireland, and it's occasionally raised its head, particularly in the context of cuts affecting disadvantaged schools or children with special education needs. This weekend, that issue appears to have come centre stage. I'm talking about the question of state funding for fee-paying schools. Minister Rory Quinn this weekend said he would review the practice whereby the government gives capital grants to schools which charge fees to pupils, many of which are in very affluent parts of Dublin. Figures given to RTE by the Department of Education and Skills show that €8 million in building grants have been given to fee-paying schools since 2008. Of that, almost €6 million went to minority faith schools and about €2 million to Catholic fee-paying schools. Much of the discourse surrounding state support for such schools tends to exclude Protestant and other faith schools, since these are seen as providing a faith-based education to children who have no choice but to attend them. But a number of these schools actually serve large numbers of Catholic children, which leaves the distinction between them and Catholic fee-paying schools somewhat open to debate. In any case, some of the largest building grants in recent years went to some very well-regarded Catholic fee-paying schools, including the Dominican College in Newbridge, Blackrock College, Loretto Abbey in Dalkey, and Holy Child and St Joseph of Cluny, both of which are located in Killiney, County Dublin. Speaking on RTE Radio, Minister Quinn indicated that in future, Exchequer monies will have to be prioritised for schools that most depend on them. Now, what will most surprise and dismay many parents who send their children to state schools is the amounts of capital funding given to Catholic fee-paying schools in a fairly small area of South Dublin. Catholic fee-paying schools don't receive capitation grants from Exchequer funds, and it might have been expected that they would have to fend for themselves as well in terms of building programmes. Many South Dublin state schools saw their enrolments decline during the Celtic Tiger years as fee-paying schools in the area boomed. Those parents in the capital who have kept faith with state education over the years could be forgiven for asking why the public funds spent in private schools weren't spent on improving facilities in state primary and secondary schools at a time when those monies were available and badly needed. It's an issue that which I think will not be going away in the short term, and we'll certainly keep you informed as it develops. Well, this weekend's focus on the issue of Exchequer funding of private schools follows on from the midweek announcement of the government's job initiative. An extra €30 million has been allocated to this year's summer work scheme, almost doubling its budget. None of the new funds have gone to projects in fee-paying schools. Over 60 Dublin schools have secured funding for repairs and enhancements this summer, and the department expects the increased money to generate almost 3,000 direct and indirect jobs over the period. Elsewhere, the jobs initiative, almost 16,000 education and training places will be available for adult learners across PLC courses, back to education, FOS courses and the higher education Springboard programme. Now, there's been a broad welcome for the education announcements in the Jobs Initiative, but the TUI was on hand with a bucket of cold water, pointing out that last year 90,000 people applied for 31,000 PLC places, and that the additional places for these courses will still leave a huge shortfall. The TUI also reminded us that students on these courses will have to pay a €200 fee from this autumn. The other big news of the week was the publication by the Department of Education of a set of statistics showing that 87.7% of Irish teenagers now stay in school to leaving cert level. That 2010 figure is up from 81.3% in 1996. The figure is adjusted to account for students who left state-aided schools, emigrated or died. In terms of the unadjusted figures, a gender gap of 4.1% still exists between boys and girls. 86.5% of girls and 82.5% 11.4% of boys now complete their Leaving Cert, and the gender gap itself is down from 11.3% of students who entered secondary school in 1995. County Longford has the highest overall retention rate to Leaving Cert at 89.4%, followed by Mayo at 88.6%. Limerick City had the lowest rate of school completion at 77.6%, followed by Dublin City at 80.1% and Cork City at 80.6%. The ASTI described the figures as a morale boost for the education system, but the TUI warned of the effects of cutbacks, particularly in year-head posts, saying that these could wipe out the improvement in retention rates unless targeted intervention is made. Finally, this week, discussions are still ongoing regarding the new arrangements for the standardised school year. You might recall that following the prolonged snow closures in 2010, the Department of Education is seeking to build flexibility into the school holidays to allow for time to be made up. It's still expected that this will involve the shortening of the February midterm break and the Easter holidays, but agreement hasn't yet been reached. In the meantime, the Halloween break will run from October 31st to November the 4th, and the Christmas holidays will begin on the 22nd of December, running until the 9th of January. And that is this week's Education News, Sean.
Thank you very much, Barry. It's hard to think we're thinking of December already.
Indeed, with the summer just around the corner.
Indeed. Well, thank you, Barry, for that. And Barry Hennessy will, of course, be back at the same time next week. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes from on iTunes or from our website, www.insideed.com. You can also email us at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Our email address again is insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Well, for many years now, anyone who wants to become a teacher in Ireland needs to study subjects such as philosophy of education, history of education, curriculum studies, sociology of education, and psychology. Collectively, these subjects are known as the foundation disciplines of education, and they are the subject of a new book entitled Education Studies in Ireland, The Key Disciplines. It's published by Gill and Macmillan. The text is intended for anyone setting out to become a teacher or anyone generally who is studying education. The editor of the book is Dr. Brendan Walsh of Dublin City University. Brendan Walsh is Director of Teaching Practice at Dublin City University, where he lectures in the fields of history of education, educational policy and teaching methodology. In the book, each of the disciplines, philosophy, history, curriculum studies, sociology and psychology, is given its own chapter, written by education scholars from around Ireland. Brendan Walsh begins by outlining what the chapters do for their disciplines.
Really what they're supposed to do is to give people an introduction into them, what the main ideas are, who the main thinkers are, the main schools, and that's why we try to give really comprehensive reading lists at the end, so there'd be a jumping off board for students, but at least it would get them started, and then they could go and look up, they could read into the course after that, you know.
The subtitle for the book is The Key Disciplines, and for the purpose of the book, how do you define a discipline?
Well, this is a tricky one, I have to be honest. There is a long-standing debate over key disciplines in most areas of study, whether they be, you know, law or sociology or whatever else. We decided, or I decided when I sat down, to take what we thought were the disciplines in which, if you're going to be involved in the study or practice of education, you need to have a familiarity with these as a practicing teacher or educator. Some of them, I suppose, because of their history, have a prior call on people, like philosophy and so on and so forth. So there's two things. One is they've been deemed to be important historically and culturally by people who are involved in educational studies. And secondly, they're disciplines without a knowledge of which practitioners won't be able to practice as they should under, and even if you want to put it crudely, under the terms of the teaching council and so on. And I'm conscious of the fact there's a lot of things that are not in the book. But at the same time, the concept of key disciplines has been slightly under threat. And in the UK, they've almost jettisoned them to make things sort of very relevant and so on and so forth. But there's a risk there, I think, of losing your moorings. So in some sense, it's a bit controversial saying there are key disciplines. But I think most of us would agree there are.
And what would be lost then to education and to our understanding of education if we did do what they've done in the UK and take away the disciplines?
The best way I could put that is there's a sort of saying that people come up with is that teaching gets in the way of educating. So in Ireland, we've tried to hold on to the idea that preparing people for teaching, and I'm speaking as someone who taught for 10 years myself in secondary schools, we've tried to hold on to the notion that in some way teachers are transformative agents as well. They're not simply enacting the curriculum, well, that's the main thing that they do, but they're supposed to be reflective, they're supposed to grow as they go along and so on. So the idea of constructing an education system that just simply reflects current perceived needs and so on and so forth is something that we've tended to resist. I think sensibly, because if we look at the last 10 years or so, we would have a lot of our graduates from this university and other universities, in a sense, who were sold a pup, engineers, construction studies kids, architects and so on, because we did meet those perceived needs and those kids are now unemployed or emigrated. So I think the argument for educationists would be there are things that are more substantive, more substantial about the practice of education other than meeting just current needs. So I think a lot would be lost, hugely, if we decided to just construct an education system to meet what were deemed to be present needs all the time, which by and large most politicians and commentators think is the way an education system should operate.
And if we go then to the specific disciplines that are chosen, I mean, there are some that are not there. For example, you could argue that educators would benefit from having a sense of anthropology or a sense of economics, even in the current climate, or maybe neuropsychology and how brain neural patterns work. Why? What is the case for having the specific ones you have in the book, which are philosophy, psychology, curriculum studies, history and sociology?
Well, they're partly historical, Sean. I mean, the sense that in one sense, I suppose, they're historical in that these have always been deemed by educators to be disciplines that we feel important for people going into to work in educational practice. On the other hand, I mean, I agree with you in the sense that had we done tried to do a text which took everything in, we couldn't have published a text because it'd be so big. So what we decided to do was provide as much reading as we could in the reading list at the back to allow people to sort of take that reading list and go off and study those areas themselves afterwards. But I think it is the case nonetheless that the educational community will accept that there are key principles or key disciplines on which you should on which we should base the practice of education. And I think that Dr. Scanlon she'd have looked into the things that you mentioned from the point of view of developmental psychology and so on for children in school in her chapter. The important thing, I think, is for people to get in when they have an introduction to that is to then follow the reading list and take it, you know, go off and have a substantial read of or study into that area. You know.
And is there any grounds to claim that education itself is a discipline rather than being an area that's built on other disciplines?
I think it is a discipline itself for this reason. I tend to joke that it's the second oldest profession. Humanity has always been involved in educating. As soon as you had to teach a child to do something in a cave, they've been educating. And therefore, a very substantial body of theoretical and practical knowledge has been built up, which is particular to an individual, to the practice of education. And consequently, I think one of the complaints, I suppose, always from DIP students is, you know, the theory, and it's a white knuckle ride during their year. And we were all the same. But at the same time, to say that there isn't a theory in the discipline is to say your discipline has no theory. So, which is an insane thing to say. You'd never say that of medicine or law or whatever else. So whether or not there are, I think there is, for example, a philosophy of education in the sense that philosophers have dedicated, many, many, many years and substantial amounts of work, as have historians and so on, to looking at the discipline of education specifically. Does it sit within a field of philosophy? You'd have to ask the philosophers. But I think in my own discipline, we certainly would have a community of historians who are committed to history of education specifically, but we're obviously very cognizant of the theory of history generally, and we would see ourselves as sitting within the broader community of historians.
And if we stay with your own chapter for the moment, Brendan, one of the things you say in the introduction is that the history of education you tell is but one telling of the story. And how else could the story be told, and what would the implications of a different telling be?
I think, again, yeah, well, to answer that question, you have to look at historiography generally. I mean, all tellings of anything are one telling in the sense, and it's the same famous old adage that the victors get to write history and so on and so forth. But the story I've told essentially is it's the macro history of it. There's very little about teachers in it, for example, or children in school or textbooks and so on and so forth. So what it tends to be is the colonial history, how the system came about structurally, its management, the role of the church, the white papers, the green papers and so on. Another way of telling that story is to talk only about, for example, the practitioners themselves, teachers, who haven't left much of a record, is something I'm trying to research at the moment. You could look simply at the development of school, for example, from the point of view of buildings, architecture, children's texts, children's games. The parents are not involved in it. The parents' interaction with education over the years. So there are lots of different ways of telling the story. In reality, in history, you never tell the full story because I don't know what's in an attic somewhere in someone's archives. So really it is that, and I wouldn't like, in a sense, for anyone to think for a moment that chapter is the telling of the development of education in Ireland. It is a macro history. It's a Cook's tour. And there are, in any story in history, there will be other ways of telling it. That's why we differ with each other all the time.
And in the chapter that you have told, one of the things that struck me in it is the huge influence of the churches on education, and also now, more recently, the arrival of the Teaching Council. How do you think the Teaching Council and the relationship between the Catholic Church in particular and schools will shape education in Ireland over the next, say, 10 years?
Oh, that's an interesting one. I think the history of the church, is as it is. And I think from my own point of view, I think one of the difficulties or one of the possible problems with the conversation around church involvement now is the fact that we'll actually forget the commitment of the church and what they've done. And regardless of the appalling news we've had over the years with regard to child abuse and so on and so forth, there were very large numbers of religious communities opening and closing schools for nothing. When I mean opening and closing schools, I mean opening the gates of schools at 7 in the morning and locking them again at 10 at night and so on. So I think that's what, as an historian's point of view, I'm keen that they don't get written out of history. I think the advent of the Teaching Council, this is a discussion that's been going on for 30, 35 years. I think on a personal level, the advent of the teaching community is a good thing. It's self-policing, like a medical council and so on. We need that, particularly around areas of good practice and what have you. On the other hand, I think the jury's out. The Teaching Council is very young. It remains to be seen whether or not it's a body that's going to be of any benefit to teachers in the long run. The jury's out. I mean, that's no criticism of the Teaching Council. I'm glad it's there. And whether or not it's worth being there, we have to wait and see. I was a bit concerned that, for example, last year or so we had a proposal that unemployed engineers go in and teach maths in schools. Now, our undergraduates here who are learning to be maths teachers and taking 3 or 4 years to do it, and science teachers, I thought that really I would have liked to have heard something from the Teaching Council on that publicly, and I don't think we did. We have to go back to the ASTI, in fairness to them, to hear comments about that. So it remains to be seen what the council do.
And just for people who are listening and who might say, well, what's the problem with people who are very good at maths and science because they're studying engineering? What's wrong with them teaching those subjects?
Well, they haven't learned how to teach. So being good at maths doesn't mean you can teach it. It's a simple answer. It really doesn't. I mean,
So what does a teacher then bring to the teaching of those subjects that, say, an engineer or a mathematician mightn't?
Well, first thing I would hope that, generally people who have studied for 3 or 4 years to become, in the sense of DCU, we're a little bit different because we have these undergraduate degrees for people who want to be physical education and science teachers or science teachers, and then we have this 2-year part-time HDIP or G graduate diploma, as it's now known. So all those people, what all those people bring to the table is a desire to teach for a start, which is not a desire to be an architect or an engineer. That's a different discipline, and it's a terrific discipline and so on, but it's a different discipline. So what they are unqualified teachers. And as a young man at the INTO conference said 2 weeks ago, he's an unqualified pilot, which is a metaphor I use myself all the time. So I think they don't know pedagogy. They haven't learned basics of classroom management. They haven't learned about how you construct lesson plans and so on. They don't know anything about developmental psychology of children. They know maths, but knowing maths doesn't mean you can convey maths. They'd be more than welcome to come back and study how to be teachers with us if teaching is what they want to go into. And we get a lot of people doing that. We really do, who've been in business or out in jobs for a number of years and find it unfulfilling, or unfortunately are finding that the access to employment has been blocked in that way, so because of the way the economy's gone. So it's not that the discipline is less or more, it's that it there are disciplines you have to study and things you have to know to work in classrooms, otherwise we'd all do it.
One tension that's often spoken about in education circles, Brendan, is the tension between theory and practice. And I wonder, how do you resolve this tension in your own mind?
I think you're absolutely right. And a lot of complaint for the last, I've interviewed teachers recently for my own research who did their higher diploma in education in the 60s, and they say the same thing. Okay, it was far too theoretical and so on. So I think one of the difficulties is the way that initial teacher education is constructed for teachers in Ireland. The idea being essentially it's 7 months, that's an academic year. they have to get 35, 40 years of teaching out of that. So it's what has been called an inoculation period. So for, I think what we've done here, for example, is we have front loaded practice, classroom management, that kind of thing, and back loaded theory into the second year. But the truth of the matter is that the HDIP needs to be considerably longer, maybe with a year or two break in it, where and then where students come back to have a theoretical basis a year or two later. And just out of interest on that, some research I did in Maynooth some years ago with a colleague down there, we found that people who had already been out teaching for 3 or 4 years and had come back to do their HDIP were very keen for theory. They wanted to know about developmental psychology, they wanted to know about sociology, they wanted to know about how the education system thought about itself and operated, because they'd managed the classroom management and the testing bit, so to speak, you know. Whereas the youngsters who were coming in more or less straight off their degree, they want to know about classroom management and, you know, getting the kids quiet. So your needs differ as you progress in the job, and trying to cram it all into 7 months. In fact, really what a country or a government thinks about education and teaching is summarised in the fact that we give them 7 months to learn it. And you don't need to say any more than that.
At post-primary, anyway.
At post-primary. Oh, yeah, absolutely, post-primary.
Can you give any concrete examples of how the key disciplines of education actually influence practice? Or another way of thinking about it is, how could I tell if I was watching an incident in a classroom whether or not a teacher had a background in history of education or in psychology of education or philosophy and so on?
You won't, generally speaking, in some of the disciplines, yes, and some of the disciplines, no. You will, for example... It's difficult, it's not explicit in the sense that you may see a teacher behaving in a particular way in a classroom, the way they move, the way they gesticulate, the way they position their body in a classroom, the way they use their eyes to tell a child that they would like them to refocus on a text or something else. Now, the reason why they're doing those things, some students of teaching will have an instinct towards these things, okay, which can be built on, which is fantastic. Others will have gone through classroom management here or in whatever university or college they're in. They'll remember from their developmental psychology the use of the face or the use of the body or the use of the voice and so on and so forth. So they will bring it to practice, but it's not explicit. They generally won't think, I remember from this, because they've got 30 kids there and so on and so forth. On other disciplines, for example, the philosophy, what philosophy of education generally encourages students to do is think about the nature and purpose of what it is they're doing. And that very much can affect their practice. I mean, if they believe, for example, in the concept, the worth of the curriculum or a liberal education, or that education helps us to be more human and more civilised, however you define that and so on, they'll bring that, not so much in the explicit curriculum, but they'll bring it into the classroom and the way they talk to children, the books they lend them, the way they talk about their discipline, the extra things they give them. For example, you know, the teachers who go beyond the curriculum in physics or history or whatever it is and really, really get kids switched on about their discipline, they tend to have a philosophy of education, beliefs about education and learning that they can articulate. And they generally tend to form those when they're studying education studies to begin with. So they are crucial. There is no practice without theory. Unless we have a theoretical basis on which we base our practice, then there is no practice, or there's just poor practice. Because unless people are studying how this thing operates, how it works, how it can be improved, what doesn't work, and so on, unless they're building up a theory, unless that community of educators, teachers as well, as people like myself who are working in universities, unless we're having that conversation, practice just will sort of find itself in a cul-de-sac. And the fact that we do have that conversation, even though I suppose teachers will say, oh, it's very theoretical and so on, you know, initial teacher education, that, but the fact that we have that theory is demonstrable by the fact that teaching has changed so utterly in many respects over the last 20, 30, 40 years, and certainly over the last 100 years. And that's because psychologists, philosophers and so on sit down, they study, they analyse, they talk, they seek improvements, they try them, they work, they don't work. And that's how practice changes. I mean, the huge one would have been the advent of child-centeredness at the beginning of the 20th century. If we hadn't had people outside the box, the Pestalozzis and all the rest of the Montessoris, we wouldn't have that. And our primary schools would look very, very, very different places now. They'd be Bell and Lancaster, there'd be 100 kids in a room. Speaking of my own discipline, the history of education, when you start to look to people that affect change, like Pestalozzi or Montessori or Dewey or so on, sometimes they are a little bit on the fringes, or they're not educators at all, like Montessori is a doctor, medical doctor. But at the same time, they can tend to be sort of the sexy ones, or the ones that get the headlines. On the other hand, there are, you know, schools of education, departments of education, all around the world all day today, researching all the time on what's working, what's not working, and research of learning and so on. So I think that I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever that that kind of research affects, in the same way as research on the sociology of medicine or so on, or if you look at the sort of work the School of Nursing do here and the kind of conferences they have and so on these kind of wider aspects of nursing, they're not necessarily clinical. They're to do with other aspects. And that is how things change in practice and in society outside, by looking at the context of our practice in a wider society and changing, if we need to change our practice, to meet that. I mean, the coming of ICT or multicultural classrooms, or classrooms where you would have children that don't, maybe half of the class don't have English as a first language and so on. We need to meet those changes, but you need to meet them in an intelligent and reflective way that works out in a way that's best for the kids that are in those classrooms. And you can't do that just by going in and teaching all the time. You have to think about what you're doing.
Finally, Brendan, teacher education programmes are currently being redesigned in Ireland at the moment. What role do you see for the disciplines in the future?
I think that the disciplines, the truth of the matter is, as times change, disciplines tend to change as well. I mean, they're not archaic, they're not in an ivory tower, they reflect social change as it goes along. But I think you'll always have a space for intelligent reflection on what it is we do. You might call that different things. And some of the disciplines have come under pressure, as we said earlier on, in other countries. But I think you will always have these things that they're core to study because, in a sense, without studying them, you can't become what they call an effective practitioner. But other than that as well, education is not just about teaching. And when I say just about teaching, I don't mean just teaching, because speaking as a teacher myself for many, many years. They are also about thinking as an educator, and in some way being empowered to be an educator and have a part to play in the conversation about education at a political, social level, not simply being enacting in the classroom. So the fact, I suppose, in a way that the DIP forces people, in some sense, to take a position, initial teacher education does, is a good thing, whether they like it or not, in a sense, that they are forced to confront these issues and say, OK, enacting the curriculum is one thing I do, but as a professional educator, I have a role to play as well in informing society about what I do. I have a right to talk about this, a right to talk about it intelligently, because I'm the person who's at the coalface here. So I think teaching is an aspect of educating, but they're not necessarily always the same thing. They link, okay? But at the same time, you wouldn't be much of a teacher if you weren't educating.
And that was Dr. Brendan Walsh of Dublin City University, who spoke to me to mark the publication by Gill and Macmillan of Education Studies in Ireland, The Key Disciplines. And Brendan Walsh edited that volume. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us on insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guest Brendan Walsh and to Barry Hennessy for the education news. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.